I don't know if you noticed it or not, but when Stephen gave me his list of songs that he'd selected to lead today, I didn't see how he left me any choice but to preach about heaven. Now, that's a good thing. A lot of times we pick our songs out to go with the sermon, but this time he was ready first, and so I figured, in all fairness, I should follow his lead this time. And so this morning I've entitled our study, My Father's House. Our text is John chapter 14, verses 1 through 3, which Nicholas read to us just a few minutes ago. And while I realize that that picture that you see on the screen there is really nothing more than just a fanciful artist concept for the purpose of illustration, maybe it will serve the purpose of reminding us that heaven and its details are really beyond our imagination, beyond our ability to imagine. Now, that doesn't mean that the Bible doesn't tell us quite a bit about heaven, because it does. In fact, you might be surprised to find some of the references to heaven are scattered throughout Scripture, even in some rather obscure places, or at least we might call them obscure, in the Old Testament. The Bible tells us quite a bit about the duration of heaven. Heaven is eternal. It will never end. It will be an existence for us that will never cease. It's not going to be like life on earth, which comes to an end with death, but in heaven there will be no end to its duration. It has no duration. It is eternal. The Bible also describes in great detail some of the conditions that we will exist under in heaven, particularly in describing our existence in heaven as being so far in contrast from our existence on this earth. A lot of the things that we know and experience and particularly feel that are negative things will not exist in heaven. There'll be no tears, no dying. There'll be no sorrow. There won't be any trouble of any kind. There won't be any turmoil. There will not be any conflict. Rather, everything in heaven will be good. And then the Bible does also, in a very figurative sense, get around to telling us some things that we might say are physical descriptions of heaven. In the closing chapters of the book of Revelation, in particular, we read about the street of gold and the gates around, or the gates in the wall around the city that are made of all of the precious stones and the jewels, and all of those kind of things are referred to there. And it's obvious that those are just simply terms that are used in an effort to describe something that is really so far beyond our ability to understand, and yet those are just the best words we have. The fact is, heaven is beyond our ability to understand. This, you might say, is a sermon about home. And with that in mind, and in view of the fact that we aren't able to understand exactly everything about how heaven will be, I want to begin by reading you an illustration from an old preacher who wrote and spoke more than 150 years ago. In a sermon on the subject of heaven, he tells this story. He said, "A little child whose mother was dying was taken away to live with some friends because it was thought that she could not understand what death is. All the while, the child wanted to go home and see her mother. Her mother died, and at last, when the funeral was over and she was taken back home, she ran all over the house searching the sitting room, the parlor, the library, the bedrooms. She went from one end of the house to the other, and when she could not find her mother, she wanted to be taken back to where they had brought her from. He says, home had lost its attractions for the child when her mother was no longer there. He concludes his story with this. He says, my friends, the great attraction in heaven will not be its pearly gates, its golden streets, nor its chorus of angels, but it will be Christ. Heaven would be no heaven if Christ were not there. You know, I believe he makes a valid point. And while it is necessary for us to cling in some sense to some of those descriptions of the conditions and the duration and even the physical words that we sometimes use to describe it, the most important thing about heaven is that we will always be with the Lord. Again, let's read those verses from John chapter 14, verses 1 through 3. And then I'd like for us to take another look at those very familiar words. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. I want to suggest two or three things about this passage. And first of all, I want to suggest to you that these words are words of great comfort. Now, don't take that statement lightly, because it goes a little bit deeper than we might imagine. I suppose it would be true to say that many, if not most of us, have viewed this particular passage as, well, sort of a standalone text. The fact is, it's part of a discussion that has gone on in John's account of the Gospels. In fact, what John records in chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, Matthew, Mark, and Luke record in only just a few verses. John is telling about this discussion that Jesus has with his apostles that takes place the evening before his crucifixion. He begins with this explanation in John chapter 13 and verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of the world to the Father. This was a time that Jesus realized was his last opportunity to have this very meaningful discussion with these men who loved him so dearly. And so it was on this occasion that the first thing the Lord did, according to John's record, was to lay aside his outer garments and gird himself with a towel. and go around the group washing the feet of each one of those men. It was just a few minutes after that and in the course of this discussion and supper that Jesus identified the one who would betray him to the Jewish leaders, which would result in his arrest and crucifixion by the Romans. It was also in this discussion that Jesus warned Peter of the fact that he was going to deny Jesus. In chapter 13, verse 38, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times." And then after saying that, the next words of Jesus are, "Let not your hearts be troubled." And so you see, the things that have happened up to this point in that room on that evening as they are all gathered together make our understanding more complete of why the Lord would begin this discussion with the words, "Let not your heart be troubled." I am fairly sure that we are not able, being so far removed from the experience of the disciples during the Lord's ministry, and with only the briefest of explanations in the New Testament, we're unable, I'm sure, to understand and to truly relate to the state of mind that those men were experiencing on that evening. Just the very weight of all of the emotional considerations upon those men on this occasion would be enough to derail our thoughts and send our minds into turmoil. But I do believe that the details that we have on record of the things that happened that evening do serve as great instruction and priceless lessons for each of us to learn as we read about what happened on that evening in that room. There is the tremendous lesson of humility and service to be learned from Jesus' actions of washing the feet of his disciples. There is the wonderful lesson of faith that can be learned from the Lord's obvious and very tremendous trust in God's will and God's plan. There is the lesson, the very important lesson of caution that can be learned from Judas' example of selling out to worldly desires and his lust for money. And how could we miss the lesson of forgiveness learned through Peter's experience in the events of this very long night and the days just following the Lord's resurrection? And so, as in every case, there is great importance in these words, and particularly in these words as Jesus delivered them on that evening. These men needed great comfort. These men would need, in the hours to come and in the days to come, they would need tremendous words of comfort to think back on and to stand on. And by extension, we today also, in fact, One of the more frequent uses of these words in a public gathering would have to be the reading of them in funeral services, comforting those who have lost loved ones. When we bring the application of comfort home to ourselves, we begin to realize that there is no situation that can come upon us when we should not be able to turn to the Lord and to His Word in order to obtain a certain level of comfort in the face of some terrible challenges. Specifically, these are words of great comfort because they reach across life into eternity, and they speak of our eternal home. Oh, if we could only wean ourselves off of the things of this life. All of these things that we put so much stock in, all of these things that the world insists to us are irreplaceable, all of these things that literally have an expiration date. If only we could wean ourselves off of those things and fix our attention on that eternal home. As Paul reminds us in Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2, if you then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things of this earth. Peter reminds us of what we have waiting for us if we will but live in steadfast faithfulness. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, he calls it an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. All that we have and all that we know now, Everything on earth is temporary. Things that are seen, things that are temporal, things that are described as momentary. But what Jesus is speaking of here is the eternal weight of glory. And so not only are these words of great comfort, but they are so because they are words of precious promise. The promise of home. In my Father's house are many mansions. I'm told that the New American Standard Version and some others have it a little bit more accurately, at least according to our understanding, in saying that in my Father's house are many dwelling places. We've sung about it this morning with words so eloquent reminding us of that great home. There's a mansion now empty, just waiting for me. I've a home prepared where the saints abide, just over in the glory land. There where the tempest will never be sweeping us, sure that forever the Lord will be keeping us. Won't it be wonderful there? When shall I be forever blessed? When shall I see the Father's face and in His bosom rest? I'm bound for the promised land. So far as words go, I've often heard it said that the two most comforting words in our culture, in the English language, are the words mother and home. Jesus expresses this concept in His words, the concept of home. my Father's house, he calls it. I can relate to that. I don't call it my Father's house anymore. I call it my mother's house because my father has gone on to his eternal home. But while Dad was alive, and I would ever say, going to Dad's house, you knew where I was going. You knew that it was a particularly special place to me, partially because it was Dad's house. It was home. We hear people say things sometimes like, well, I'm going back home this weekend. Going back to see the folks? Yeah, going home. I actually lived in Vernon, Alabama just a relatively short time. In fact, I've often said that I've been gone away from that little town from where I graduated high school for so long that I couldn't even begin to find my way around the little streets of that little town of 2,192 on the sign there at the city limits when I graduated from high school. I've spent many, many more years in other places, but there is a sense in which I still refer to that place on Highway 17 there as home. And you understand that. We do put special stock in many cases in that word home. That's the concept that I believe we need to see. In fact, it's reflected in a song that we'll be singing tonight. We sing it quite regularly. And I invite you to think seriously about those words tonight when we sing, "This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." Home. My Father's house. Those terms imply residence. Those terms imply family. And then Jesus says in verse 3, "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also." We will be there with him. That promise takes us back to our childhood, or maybe at least reminds us of the words that some of us hear quite frequently these days. Some little fellow or little gal says, "Can I go? Can I go? Daddy's going to town. Can I go?" Recall the words of Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Beginning at verse 6, he says, "Therefore, being always of good courage and knowing that while we're at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord." Do you understand what Paul's saying there? He's saying, I sure do wish I could go ahead and go to heaven. That's what he's saying. Then over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 17 and 18, he says, describing the end, "Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words." Oh, these precious words of promise. Consider, lastly, that these words speak clearly of preparation. Jesus speaks of his work of preparation, "For I go to prepare a place for you," verse 2. What exactly is he doing? Well, we don't know. In fact, preparing a place for us, that's human terminology. I'm not really even very sure about how literally that concept applies to heaven, except in the expressing of the idea that this is not something that just happened, it's not something that was just thrown together, but this is something that has purpose and plan and has been brought together intentionally. I think there's great significance in the idea that the Son of God says He is preparing a place for us. Recall with me some of the passages that mention this kind of preparation. For example, in Jesus' parable about the wedding feast in Matthew chapter 22, the man had everything ready and he told his servants to go out and contact the guests who had been invited and tell them, "Behold, I have prepared my dinner." And as that song says, we sing, "All things are ready. Come to the feast." And then in Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus describes the judgment scene, He says the king will say to those on His right, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Again, there's the idea that this is long in planning, something that has purpose behind it. Then in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 16, as the writer is speaking of those great old heroes of faith in the Old Testament, he says, "Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them." There is also in these words the implication that we must be prepared for our eternal home. Because Jesus, in fact, mentions readiness many times in His teaching. Matthew 24, verse 44, "For this reason also you must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Matthew 25, in verse 10, in the discussion of the 10 virgins, "The foolish ones, you remember, had not brought enough oil with them for their lamps in order to last for a long time. And so," verse 10 says, "and while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut." Are we ready? Have we made the preparation? Are we ready for that eternal home? That doesn't mean that there's not anything else that we need to be doing here, but it means that in all that we do and are doing in our lives, we must stay ready, prepared to meet our God. And so I tell you what, let's bring that down on a little bit more personal level. What about you? Are you prepared? Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ through belief, repentance, confession, and baptism? If not, there surely should be no reason to wait any longer. Everything is ready. Preparations have been made. We have all that's necessary in order to help you accomplish that. If you have already done that but have become unfaithful in your service to God, you need to come back and be restored. If you're not prepared, why not get prepared? Take whatever steps are necessary today. And as the song suggests, we're about to sing, surrender to the Lord. If you're subject to His invitation in any way, we invite you to respond as we stand together and sing.